Coming up on this week's book show, Kristen Hanna is the number one best-selling author of The Nightingale and The Great Alone. Her latest, The Four Winds, is an American epic about love and heroism and hope, set during the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, and about the people who lived through it. Kristen Hanna on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Kristen Hanna is the number one best-selling author of The Nightingale and The Great Alone. Her latest, The Four Winds, is an American epic about love and heroism and hope, set during the Great Depression, a time when the country was in crisis and at war with itself, when millions were out of work and even the land seemed to have turned against them. The Four Winds brings to life the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, and the people who lived through it, the harsh realities that divided us as a nation, and the enduring battle between the haves and have-nots, as seen through the eyes of one woman whose courage and sacrifice will come to define a generation. We will talk about her and the book with the author, Kristen Hanna, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm thrilled.
Well, I love this book, and it was such a beautiful thing to read. At what point did you say, okay, the Dust Bowl is a perfect place for me to do what I do so well?
It started with the Great Depression. I had written a book a few years ago called The Nightingale about the women of the French Resistance Right. in World War II France. And I realized how much I loved, you know, putting women in the forefront in landscapes that are more traditionally male stories and sort of relooking at history through women's eyes. And I wanted to write kind of an American Nightingale, an American epic that looked at our own history and the courage of our own people. And so that led me somehow, you know, to the Great Depression, because it was a time of such hardship, and it was, you know, pretty much hardship for everyone. And so I was really drawn to that. And then once you begin, you know, studying the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl really becomes sort of the epicenter of it, because of, you know, the real adversity and the challenges that people were facing there. I realized that I didn't know much about that story. As a West Coast girl, I hadn't learned much about it. And also that what I did know about it seemed to be predominantly male. And so I wanted to really look at how women in general and how one woman in particular would survive, you know, this hardship.
So in the prologue, page one, you write, "A man's got to fight out here to make a living," they'd say to each other. A man. It was always about the men. They seemed to think it meant nothing to cook and clean and bear children and tend gardens. But we women of the Great Plains worked from sunup to sundown too, toiled on wheat farms until we were as dry and baked as the land we loved. So you set that off from page one.
Yeah, I wasn't fooling around.
And then this story becomes very much about this incredible woman, Elsa, who I come to learn that you didn't really have her appear in the book until you were 100 pages in.
Yeah, actually more like 300.
Wow.
Yeah, I had worked on the book for almost 2 years before I realized that this needed to be her story. She is just, you know, I've written like 24 novels, and she is far and away my favorite character ever. I just love her. And so, you know, when she sort of appeared out of my subconscious and onto the page, I knew that she was the character to tell this story, because, you know, she's got this beautiful character arc where she goes from, you know, insecure and low self-esteem and unsure of herself and unloved to this warrior woman who is willing to stand up and fight not only for her children and herself, but for others who are afraid to speak out. And I just thought that was such a beautiful arc and an important message.
There is much sadness in the book, and it really begins with Elsa's story because she's such a castaway in her own family. She is cast aside by both her mother and her father, and is lesser to her other siblings, her sisters. And it's because they don't think that she's pretty enough and smart enough and ... enough to do the things that they would like her to do.
Yeah, I mean, she just doesn't fit the mold in her family of what a woman is supposed to be at that time and what a woman is supposed to do. And, you know, I'm always drawn to this idea that our self-image is so formed by what we learn in childhood and what we are taught about ourselves by our parents. And I really wanted to create a character who began with that deficit, you know, with that idea of insecurity. And, you know, through the love of her, the family that she marries into, and the love that she feels for her own children, and the love that she feels for the farmland that belongs to the family, all of this sort of comes together to let her understand the strength that she has inside and to come to own it.
It's fascinating to me because the family that she comes into, that she marries into, is the what becomes her mother-in-law and her father-in-law, yeah, are her lifeline, and as you said, along with her own children, but they become her parents, and the love she has for them is so deep. And it's such a comparison for her throughout much of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, that is part of, or probably one of the biggest parts of how she finds her voice. And what, you know, it becomes a novel as much about motherhood and friendship as about survival. And I think that's, it's really important. Of course, I didn't know when I started this book how relevant it would feel in the modern era. But I think it's a great reminder that, you know, that we need to pull together and that we've been through hard times before and survived them.
Yeah, we complain about cloth masks, but these kids were wearing gas masks, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that comparison a lot on this book. It's really interesting.
And they were giving them to the kids in the school because there was so much dust, so much dirt, so much that was being flown around over. And this goes on for a decade.
Yes. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one thing that's been great, I guess, for me as an author, you know, having spent almost 4 years in the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, and then having this book come out in a pandemic. I do have a really strong sense of the timing, and you know, now I can much more understand what it means to go through something like this for a decade. I mean, and that's part of, I think, this whole idea of the greatest generation and why we look back on them with such admiration.
It is also about this woman's spirit who, as I said, has a lousy childhood and then falls in with this family, and then comes the depression, then comes the ecological disaster that is the Dust Bowl, and there are birds literally falling out of the sky, their cows, their horses are dying, their children, people around them are dying and leaving in droves and trying to go to a better place. And then when they get to that quote unquote better place, it's really not that much better. So it just never lets up for this woman.
Yeah, it is. It is a very, very difficult time. And one of the things that was most interesting to me was this idea of, you know, if you're on this land that you love, and this land right. means everything to you and your family, and, you know, you're sort of deeply rooted in Texas, and the farm is failing, and the Great Depression economically is crushing you, and the drought and the dust and all of that, you know, at what point do you give up on where you are and hope that there's something better, you know, down the road? And the interesting thing to me was that the vast majority of the farmers on the Great Plains stayed. Yeah. You know, they didn't go west. And that just speaks to, you know, a level of, I guess, perseverance and hope that is remarkable to me and sort of, you know, worth remarking upon. But Elsa in particular finds herself with her son's health in a situation where she simply can't stay in the dust anymore. So she has no choice but to go west. And, you know, even though she doesn't believe really that she has the strength to survive, she sort of leans into motherhood and love and goes anyway.
Kristen Hanna is our guest in this week's book show. The new novel is The Four Winds. Yes, do we stay or do we go is a huge issue in the novel. And as you just indicated, that decision is ultimately really made for Elsa because of her son's health. And this idea of a better life in California. Talk a little bit about the research of then going west, milk and honey, as you remind us several times in the novel, that this was propaganda, for want of a better term, right. That was given to people who were in the Great Plains to come west, but then they were treated so horribly.
Well, and you know, what happened historically was, you know, the big farmers in California needed workers. A lot of the Mexican workers had been deported. And so they needed people desperately to work the fields. And of course, the Great Depression had so many people out of work. So they sent all of this advertising, you know, saying, come to California, it's the land of milk and honey, jobs for everyone, you know, money on the street sort of thing. And they kept sending these advertisements and kept asking for workers long after there was still work to be had. And so as more and more and more migrants from primarily the Great Plains and the South poured into California, there were just no jobs for them. And, you know, no way to live, no way to survive. So they ended up in a much worse situation than they had left.
The umbrella term for the migrants who come is Okies, whether they're from Oklahoma or not, but they are Okies. The lack of empathy that really anyone has for these people who are so down on their luck and have really done nothing other than try to find a better life for themselves and for their children is really gut-wrenching.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that is sort of that's the story of sort of labeling people from wherever they originated as the other, and the fear that comes along with, you know, a great economic downturn and no jobs and, you know, everything looking bleak.
And what is so startling is that these are people who are rejected at hospitals and at churches and at schools.
Yeah, it's so sad. And I think that, again, you know, it's when they say that past is prologue, you know, it's all about our own history. Mm. We keep sort of repeating cycles in history. And one of the things that I love about historical fiction is it gives us the chance to look back on an era like that in our own past and really feel the emotions of it, really understand it, hopefully look at it just a little bit from the other side or from a perspective that you're not used to, and maybe learn something.
I would like to point out that the only people who really welcome them is the library and the librarian. So go libraries.
Go libraries. There's a few more people. I think there's a hairstylist.
Yes, that's true. And a hairstylist. You're right. Absolutely. So let us talk about the kids for a moment. I will tell you, and I don't think you'll be offended by this, it took me, I don't know, maybe 75 to 100 pages to warm up to Loretta. Here's a teen girl and, you know, kind of a brat. But that's what, you know, that's what that age brings, right? Male or female. They're little brats. And then this character becomes so strong and so amazing that you just fall in love with her.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I find challenging and rewarding about writing historical fiction is, you know, the idea that it's so easy to fall into the historical part that you forget that it is still ultimately about people. And so, you know, I love writing about relationships that are as of the moment today as they would have been in 1930. And one of those sort of often fractious relationships is mother-daughter. And I sort of loved how Loretta, you know, feels about her mother the way her mother feels about herself. And it takes both of them a while to break out of these, I guess, opinions that they formed really early on.
And at least in Loretta's case, it says brutal things to her mother, but her mother in some cases believes them, and then in other cases will stand up to them and ultimately forges a very strong bond.
Yeah, I mean, because it's ultimately, you know, I think that when you, as a daughter, you know, your job at 13 is to learn to stand on your own two feet and, you know, you think you're the smartest person in the world and you want to show your independence. And the person that you end up most often practicing all of that on is your mother. And, you know, the thing about motherhood is, you know, your kids say things that hurt your feelings all the time. And you just go on because you understand that, you know, they don't mean it and it's a moment. And at some point they will, you know, grow up enough to see you for who you are and vice versa.
Without giving anything away, did you know from the beginning that Elsa was not going to just be a fighter for herself and for her family, but ultimately for the cause at hand?
I did, actually. Once I gave the book to Elsa and let this be a novel about a woman finding her voice through, you know, impossibly difficult times, I knew that at the end of the novel, in some manner or form, she would have to use that voice of hers in a very powerful way. And I couldn't think of, you know, any better way than to use it to help people who were, you know, in trouble like herself.
Do you see yourself possessing those capabilities in the sense of, even to the question of do we stay or do we go, of saying, okay, I'm going to be the person who's going to go, and I'm going to be the person who is going to make this situation better, and I'm going to, I know I shouldn't go out right now, but I am going to go out right now?
You know, we always want to imagine ourselves as, you know, the heroes and, you know, the people who will go out and fight and do the right thing. And in my books, I'm constantly asking myself, okay, what would I do here? What would I do there? Because that's kind of my benchmark for creating what my characters do. But I can tell you that in this regard, because I come from a fairly itinerant family background. You know, my father is an adventurer still, and we moved around a lot. So I have a feeling I would have gone west very early.
I am fascinated by the fact that the women of this time, you had access to some of their journals, which is interesting because Elsa herself keeps a journal and is telling her story and her perspective, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's great about the journals of the era on any historical novel is you get all of those telling details. You get, you know, moments of absolute clarity, even if there's no emotion in them. You know, things like when the dust storm hit, the centipedes crawl out from the walls.
Right.
Or that the chickens are, you know, too lethargic to lift their heads. All these little details like that, which allow me to really paint the picture of the world I'm trying to create. And I think that, you know, really with historical fiction, with any fiction, it really is about world building. It's about taking all the facts that I have corralled and given you just the ones that you need in a way that you can visualize them quickly.
So when it comes to the research, what was it like, and what did you come across that really helped you understand the women of that time?
Well, you know, I went and spent a great deal of time on the Great Plains and drove Route 66 and, you know, all of that. The migrant camp, there's part of it is still in existence in Arvin, California, right out of Bakersfield. So I was able to go stand in one of, you know, the little cabins that they rented and able to see the land where the ditch bank camps were and that sort of thing. And then there was this great resource at University of Texas at Austin. And one of the women who worked at one of the FSA camps, the state camps, had interviewed migrants and tried to find out what they needed and what their life was like. And all of her original notes are at Austin.
That's Sonora Babb, right?
Yes, yes.
Who you quote in the book, "One thing was left as clear and perfect as a drop of rain, the desperate need to stand together. They would rise and fall, and in their falling, rise again." Tell me her story, because, man, she got screwed in this deal too, didn't she?
She so did, and that's why I really wanted to, you know, put her name in the book and use that quote, and I think I mentioned her novel in the back of the book. It's, you know, she was working at these camps in about 1937, 38, I think, a young woman, a novelist. She had come from the Dust Bowl area, and she was writing her great American novel about the migrant experience in California. And so she was, you know, interviewing these people, doing this work. This was her job. And every day she was taking all of these notes that she was writing up and giving them to her boss. And in the evenings, she was writing her novel. So unbeknownst to her, her boss is giving all of her notes to John Steinbeck while he is writing The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never found any proof or anything that he used any of her notes, simply that he was given them. And she sold her book to the great Bennett Cerf and was finishing it up. And, you know, her editor thought it was going to be, you know, the next great American novel. And then Grapes of Wrath came out, and Sonora was not able to publish her novel for decades.
Ultimately, 2004, when the University of Oklahoma Press published Whose Names Are Unknown.
Yeah,
by
exactly.
Sonora Babb. Let's also talk for a moment about Dorothea Lange's photographs and the influence they had on this novel.
You know, they were huge. You know, FDR put together a program to put people at work during the Depression, and he hired or put to work a lot of artists. So there were writers and photographers out you know, documenting the era. And all of us have seen, you know, the Dorothea Lange photos. But the one that really sticks with me, there's one called The Woman of the Great Plains. And it just was, it was my inspiration for Elsa. And I think in a lot of ways, my inspiration for the novel, because you're looking at this woman who is, you know, you can just see her despair and her fear, but she's standing tall. And so you get this sense, you know, that she's going to be okay somehow, that she's going to, you know, move forward. And so that was a real inspiration to me.
Yeah, the exhaustion and the strength are really startling.
Yes.
Yeah. I know there was a piece in the New York Times recently about you reinventing yourself. I'm wondering how much of that was conscious?
I mean, it was all very conscious for me. I'm a former lawyer, and I'm very analytical, and I'm as analytical with my own work as I am with, you know, anything else. And so over the course of my career, I've sort of reinvented the kind of novelist that I am a couple of times. One of the first reinventions was a book called Firefly Lane,
right,
which is, you know, currently out on Netflix. And that was, you know, my first big novel about a female friendship that lasts 35 years, which was a real departure from what I had been doing before that. And that sort of opened the door to me to be writing, you know, sort of big contemporary women's stories. And then with The Nightingale, I wanted to expand again and do more of putting women's lost stories in the forefront, you know, taking historical settings and predominantly male narratives and putting women at the forefront. So that's what the last few books have been.
And also becoming a, whatever this means, a literary novelist as well, which opens up so that men and women are reading your books.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely what happened, you know, with The Nightingale was seeing that, you know, men will read World War II and men read a lot about women. I think it just has to appeal to them in a certain way somehow.
So what is it like now? Have things changed for you as your process because we are in this time?
Yes, I have found, interestingly enough, that for the first time in my life, really, I'm not as creatively productive as I have been in the past. You know, I've always been able to sort of use writing as my safe place and get away from anything that was bothering me by writing. And I have been having a little more trouble in these, you know, pandemic days doing that. I've been fortunate, I guess, in the sense that I've been so busy with publicity for The Four Winds that it's been okay, but I'm about ready to start writing again. I just need a new idea.
Kristen Hannah's new novel is The Four Winds. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Kristen, what an absolute delight to have you on the program. I thank you so much for sharing your time.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun, and you stay safe.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.